The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hi, and welcome to That's a Laugh. I'm Sharon Slocox with the Triangle Radio Reading Service. June, bugs and insects and barbecue and spiders. Ah, yes, summer's here. And what is the difference between bugs and insects anyway? Dictionary.com tells us that true bugs, such as beetles, characteristically have tough forewings and lack teeth. Insects are characterized by three-part bodies, usually two pairs of wings and three pairs of legs, such as bees and mosquitoes, arthropods, spiders, ticks, centipedes, etc. It is a separate phylum from bugs and insects, but hey, just call them all bugs and be done with it. Let's not be so picky. In David Quammen's book, Flight of the Iguana, published in 1988, he starts right off with an essay about spiders, specifically black widow spiders. Let's hear from Mr. Quammen in The Face of the Spider, eyeball to eyeball, with the good, the bad, and the ugly. One evening a few years ago, I walked back into my office after dinner and found roughly 100 black widow spiders frolicking on my desk. I am not speaking metaphorically, and I am not making this up. 100 black widows. It was a vision of ghastly, breathtaking beauty, and it brought on me a wave of nausea. It also brought on a small moral crisis, one that I dealt with briskly, maybe rashly, in the dizziness of the moment, and that I've been turning back over in my mind ever since. I won't say I'm haunted by those 100 black widows, but I do remember them vividly. To me, they stand for something. They stand in their small, synecdochical way for a large and important question. The question is, how should a human behave toward members of other living species? 100 black widows probably sounds like a lot. It is, even for Tucson, Arizona, where I was living then, a habitat in which black widows breed like rabbits and prosper like cockroaches, the females of the species growing plump as huckleberries and stringing their ragged webs in every free corner of every old shed and basement window. In Tucson, during the height of the season, a person can always, on short notice, round up 8 or 10 big, robust black widows, if that's what a person wants to do. But 100 in one room? So, all right, yes, there was a catch. These in my office were newborn babies. 100 scuttering bambinos, each one no bigger than a poppy seed. Too small still for red hourglasses, too small even for red egg timers. They had the aesthetic virtue of being so tiny that even a person of good eyesight and patient disposition could not make out their hideous little faces. Their mother had sneaked in when the rains began and set up a web in the corner beside my desk. I knew she was there. I got a reminder every time I dropped a pencil and went groping for it, jerking my hand back at the first touch of that distinctive, dry, high-strength web. But I hadn't made the necessary decision about dealing with her. I knew she would have to be either murdered or else captured adroitly in a pickle jar for relocation to the wild, and I didn't especially want to do either. I had already squashed scores of black widows during those Tucson years, but by this time, I guess, I was going soft. In the meantime, she had gotten pregnant. She had laid her eggs in a silken egg sack the size of a milk dud and then protected that sack vigilantly, keeping it warm, fending off any threats, as black widow mothers do. While she was waiting for the eggs to come to term, she would have been particularly edgy, particularly unforgiving, and my hand would have been in particular danger each time I reached for a fallen pencil. Then the great day arrived. The spiderlings hatched from their individual eggs, chewed their way out of the sack, and started crawling, brothers and sisters together, up toward the orange tensor lamp that was giving off heat and light on the desk of the nitwit who was their landlord. By the time I stumbled in, 50 or 60 of them had reached the lampshade and rappelled back down on dainty silk lines, leaving a net of gossamer rigging between the lamp and the Darwin book. It happened to be an old edition of Insectivorous Plants with marbled in papers that sat on the desk. Some dozen others had already managed dispersal flights, letting out strands of buoyant silk and ballooning away on rising air, as spiderlings do, in this case, dispersing as far as the bookshelves. It was too late for one man to face one spider with just a pickle jar and an index card and his two shaky hands. By now, I was proprietor of a highly successful Black Widow hatchery. And the question was, how should a human behave toward the members of other living species? The Jain religion of India has a strong teaching on that question. The Sanskrit word is ahimsa, generally rendered in English as non-injury or the imperative do no harm. Ahimsa is the ethical centerpiece of Jainism, an absolute stricture against the killing of living beings, any living beings, and it led the traditional Jains to some extreme forms of observance. A rigorously devout Jain would burn no candles or lights, for instance, if there was danger a moth might fly into them. The Jain would light no fire for heating or cooking, again, because it might cause the death of insects. He would cover his mouth and nose with a cloth mask so as not to inhale any gnats. He would refrain from cutting his hair on grounds that the lice hiding in there might be gruesomely injured by the scissors. He could not plow a field for fear of mutilating worms. He could not work as a carpenter or a mason with all that dangerous sawing and crunching, nor could he engage in most types of industrial production. Consequently, the traditional Jains formed a distinct socio-economic class composed almost entirely of monks and merchants. Their ethical canon was not without what you and I might take to be glaring contradictions. Vegetarianism was sanctioned, plants as usual getting dismissive treatment in the matter of rights to life, but at least they took it seriously. They lived by it. They tried their best to do no harm. And this in a country, remember, where 10,000 humans died every year from snake bite, almost a million more from malaria carried in the bites of mosquitoes. The Black Widow spider, compared to those fellow creatures, seems a harmless and innocent beast. But personally, I hold no brief for ahimsa, because I don't delude myself that it's even theoretically, let alone practically, possible. The basic processes of animal life, human or otherwise, do necessarily entail a fair bit of ruthless squashing and gobbling. Plants can sustain themselves on no more than sunlight and beauty and a hydroponic diet, but not we animals. I've only mentioned this Jainist ideal to suggest the range of possible viewpoints. Modern philosophers of the animal liberation movement, most notably Pete Singer and Tom Regan, have proposed some other interesting answers to the same question. So have writers like Barry Lopez and Eugene Linden, and by their example, as well as by their work, scientists like Jane Goodall and John Lilly and Dion Fossey. Most of the attention of each of these thinkers, though, has been devoted to what is popularly, but not necessarily by the thinkers themselves, considered the upper end of the ladder of life. To my mind, the question of appropriate relations is more tricky and intriguing, also more crucial in the long run, since this group accounts for most of the planet's species as applied to the lower end, down there among the mosquitoes and worms and Black Widow spiders. These are the extreme test cases. These are the alien species who experience human malice or indifference or tolerance at its most automatic and elemental, to squash or not to squash. Mohandas Gandhi, whose own ethic of nonviolence owed much to ahimsa, was once asked about the propriety of an anti-malarial campaign that involved killing mosquitoes with DDT, and he was careful to give no simple, presumptuous answer. These are the creatures whose treatment, by each of us, illuminates not just the strength of emotional affinity, but the strength, if any, of principle. But what is the principle? Pure ahimsa, even as Gandhi admitted, is unworkable. Vegetarianism is invidious. Anthropocentrism, conscious or otherwise, is smug and ruinously myopic. What else? Well, I have my own little notion of one measure that might usefully be applied in our relations with other species, and I offer it here seriously, despite the fact that it will probably sound god-awful stupid. Eye contact. Make eye contact with the beast, the other, before you decide upon action, No kidding now. I mean, get down on your hands and knees right there in the vegetable garden and look that snail in the face. Lock eyes with that bull snake. Trade stares with a carp. Gaze for a moment into the many faceted eyes, the windows to its soul of the housefly, as it licks its way innocently across your kitchen counter. Look for signs of embarrassment or rancor or guilt. Repeat the following formula silently, like a mantra. This is some mother's darling. This is some mother's child. Then kill it if you will, or if it seems you must. I've been experimenting with the eye contact approach for some time myself. I don't claim that it has made me gentle or holy or put me in tune with a cosmic hum, but definitely it has been interesting. The hardest cases, and therefore I think the most telling, are the spiders. The face of a spider is unlike anything else a human will ever see. The word ugly doesn't even begin to serve. Grotesque and menacing are too mild. The only adequate way of communicating the effect of a spiderly countenance is to warn that it is very different and then offer a photograph. This trick should not be pulled on loved ones just before bedtime or when trying to persuade them to accompany you to the Amazon. The special repugnant power of the spider physiognomy derives, I think, from fangs and eyes. The former are too big and the latter are too many. But the fangs, well, actually, the fangs are only terminal barbs on the chelicerae, as the real jaw limbs are called, need to be large because all spiders are predators, yet they have no pincers like a lobster or a scorpion, no talons like an eagle, no social behavior like a pack of wolves. Large clasping fangs armed with poison glands are just their required equipment for earning a living. And what about those eight eyes, big ones and little ones, arranged in two rows, all bugged out and pointing every which way? My wife, the biologist, offers a theory here. They have an eye for each leg, like us, so they don't step in anything. Well, a predator does need good eyesight, binocular focus, peripheral vision. Sensory perception is crucial to any animal that lives by the hunt, and, unlike insects, arachnids possess no antenna. Beyond that, I don't know. I don't know why a spider has eight eyes. I only know that when I make eye contact with one, I feel a deep physical shudder of revulsion and of fear and of fascination. And I am reminded that the human style of face is only one accidental pattern among many, some of the others being quite drastically different. I remember that we aren't alone. I remember that we are the norm of goodness and comeliness only to ourselves. I wonder about how ugly I look to the spider. The 100 black baby black widows on my desk were too tiny for eye contact. They were too numerous, it seemed, to be gathered one by one into a pickle jar and carried to freedom in the backyard. I killed them all with a can of Raid. I confess to that slaughter with more resignation than shame, the jostling struggle for life and space being what it is. I can't swear I would do differently today, but there is this lingering suspicion that I squandered an opportunity of some sort of moral growth. I still keep their dead and dried mother and their vacated egg sac in a plastic vial on an office shelf. It's supposed to remind me of something or other. And the question continues to puzzle me. How should a human behave toward the members of other living species? Last week, I tried to make eye contact with a tarantula. This was a huge specimen, all hairy and handsomely colored, with a body as big as a hamster and legs the size of big pins. I ogled it through a sheet of plate glass. I smiled and winked, but the animal hid its face in distrust. And here's a poem titled Black Widow, from the book Encyclopedia by Douglas Florian. I am a widow. I always wear black. From my eight dainty legs to my shiny round back. Do not disturb me. My fangs carry venom. I am a widow. I don't wear blue denim. Next, Dave Barry has a close encounter of the spider kind in The Great Spider Caper Winds Up Happily, which appeared in the Chicago Tribune in August 1988. On my 41st birthday, a Sunday in July, I went out to face the spider. It had to happen. There comes a time in a man's life when he reaches a certain age, 41, and he hears a voice. Often this happens when he is lying on the couch reading about Norway in the travel section. And this voice says, "Happy birthday. Do you think you could do something about the spider?" And a man knows, just as surely as he knows the importance of batting left-handed against a right-handed pitcher, that he must heed this voice, because it belongs to his wife, Beth, who, although she is a liberated and independent and tough woman of the 80s, is deeply respectful of the natural division of responsibilities that has guided the human race for nearly 4 million years, under which it is always the woman who notices when you are running low on toilet paper, and it is always the man who faces the spider. And so I called softly for my son, Robert. "Robert," I called. And within a matter of seconds, he did not appear at my side because he was in the family room watching TV commercials for breakfast cereals that are the same color and texture as Pez candy but have less nutritional content. So I called louder. "Robert," I said, "fetch me the wooden stick that your pirate flag used to be attached to and the Peter Pan creamy style peanut butter jar with the holes punched in the lid, for I am going to face the spider." Upon hearing those words, Robert came instantly, and he looked at me with a respect that I have not seen in his eyes for some time now, not since we got the Nintendo. The Nintendo is an electronic video game that is mindless and non-creative and stupid and hateful, and Robert is much better at it than I am. He is 7, and he can consistently rescue the princess, whereas I, a 41-year-old college graduate, cannot even get past the turtles. The worst part is the way Robert says, "Good try, Dad," in a perfect imitation of the cheerfully condescending voice I used to use on him back when I could beat him at everything. I don't know where kids pick up this kind of behavior. But there was respect in Robert's eyes as I strode out to face the spider. As well there should have been. Bernice, that's the spider's technical Latin name, had erected a humongous web right outside our front door, an ideal location because in July the South Florida atmosphere consists of one part oxygen and 247 parts mosquito, which meant Bernice had plenty to eat. Also on hand in the web was her husband Bill, who, despite the fact that he was 1/16 her size, nevertheless played an important ecological role in the relationship, namely trying not to look like prey. "I may be small," Bill would say all day long in spider language, "but I'm certainly not prey. No, sir, I'm a spider. Yes, just a regular non-prey." "Shut up," Bernice would say. "Yes," Bill would point out. They were a fun couple. Nevertheless, I approached them cautiously, hoping any noise I made would be drowned out by the roar of the lawn growing. July is in what we southern Floridians call the rainy season because it would depress us too much to come right out and call it the giant armpit season. When we read the stories about drought-stricken farmers who can't grow crops in their fields, we are forced to laugh with bitter irony because down here we can, without trying, grow crops in our laundry. And now I was up to the web. And now, with my son's eyes glued on me, I drew back the pirate flag stick, and I struck. "Hey," said Bernice and Spider. "Hey, don't hit me," said Bill. "I'm prey." But it was Bernice I had my eye on. If I could poke her into the peanut butter jar, all would be well. But if she turned and lunged for me, I would have no choice as a man defending his family but to drop everything and sprint off down the road, brushing wildly at myself and whimpering. Fortunately, she went into the jar, and I got the lid on real quick, and for a while we watched her pace around and indicate via sweeping arm gestures what she was going to do to us when she got out. "I'm going to sting all your eyeballs," she was saying. "I'm going to lay 175 billion eggs in your ears. I'm going to..." This was fun, but eventually we decided it was time to get rid of Bernice, following the standard procedure recommended by leading ecologists for the disposal of revenge-crazed spiders, namely, release them on a drug dealer's lawn. Like many South Floridians, we have a house in our neighborhood that we are pretty sure is occupied by drug dealers, as indicated by subtle clues such as cars coming and going at all hours and bedsheets over the windows, etc. We decided this would make a fine new home for Bernice, so we drove casually by, and I real quick opened the jar and shook Bernice onto the lawn. She scuttled off angrily toward the house. "I'm gonna fill your nasal passages with webs," she was saying. "I'm gonna..." She was no longer our problem. We were already driving off, Robert and I, going shopping for a present for my 41st birthday. We went to Toys R Us. We'll finish with Dave Barry, who is all fired up for the 4th. This essay first appeared in the Miami Herald, June 28, 1998. This year, why not hold an old-fashioned 4th of July picnic? Food poisoning is one good reason. After a few hours in the sun, ordinary potato salad can develop bacteria the size of raccoons. But don't let the threat of agonizingly painful death prevent you from celebrating the birth of our nation, just as Americans have been doing ever since that historic first July 4th, when our founding fathers, George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, Bob Dole, and Tony Bennett, landed on Plymouth Rock. Step one in planning your picnic is to decide on a menu. Martha Stewart has loads of innovative suggestions for unique, imaginative, and tasty summer meals. So you can forget about her. If Martha Stewart comes anywhere near my picnic, she's risking a barbecue fork to the eyeball, should be your patriotic motto. Because you're having a traditional 4th of July picnic, and that means a menu of hot dogs charred into cylinders of industrial-grade carbon, and hamburgers so undercooked that when people try to eat them, they leap off the plate and frolic on the lawn like otters. Dad should be in charge of the cooking, because only Dad, being a male of the masculine gender, has the mechanical know-how to operate a piece of technology as complex as a barbecue grill. To be truly traditional, the grill should be constructed of the following materials: 4% rust-resistant steel, 58% rust, 23% hardened black grill scrunge from food cooked as far back as 1987. The scrunge should never be scraped off because it is what is actually holding the grill together. 15% spiders. If the grill uses charcoal as fuel, Dad should remember to start lighting the fire early, no later than April 10th, because charcoal, in accordance with federal safety regulations, is a mineral that does not burn. The spiders get a huge kick out of watching Dad attempt to ignite it. They emit hearty spider chuckles and slap themselves on all eight knees. This is why many dads prefer the modern gas grill, which ignites at the press of a button and burns with a steady, even flame until you put food on it, at which time it runs out of gas. While Dad is saying traditional bad words to the barbecue grill, Mom can organize the kids for a fun activity, making old-fashioned ice cream by hand, the way our grandparents' generation did. You'll need a hand-cranked ice cream maker, which you can pick up at any antique store for $1,875. All you do is put in the ingredients and start cranking. It makes no difference what specific ingredients you put in because, I speak from bitter experience here, no matter how long you crank them, they will never, ever turn into ice cream. Scientists laugh at the very concept. Ice cream is not formed by cranking, they point out. Ice cream is formed by freezers. Our grandparents' generation wasted millions of man hours trying to produce ice cream by hand. This is what caused the Great Depression. When the kids get tired of trying to make ice cream, allow about 25 seconds for this. It's time to play some traditional July 4th games. One of the most popular is the sack race. All you need is a bunch of old-fashioned burlap sacks, which you can obtain from the J. Peterman catalog for $227.50 apiece. Call the kids outside, have them line up on the lawn, and give each one a sack to climb into. Then shout, "Go!" and watch the hilarious antics begin as one by one the kids sneak back indoors. Come nightfall, though, everybody will be drawn back outside by the sound of loud, traditional 4th of July explosions coming from all around the neighborhood. These are caused by the fact that various dads, after consuming a number of traditionally fermented beverages, have given up on conventional charcoal lighting products and escalated to gasoline. As the spectacular pyrotechnic show lights up the night sky, you will begin to truly appreciate the patriotic meaning of the words to the Star-Spangled Banner, written by Francis Scott Key to commemorate the fledgling nation's first barbecue. and the grill parts red glare, flaming spiders in air. Someone call 911, there's burning scrunch in Dad's hair. After the traditional visit to the hospital emergency room, it's time to gather round and watch Uncle Bill set off the fireworks that he purchased from a roadside stand operated by people who spend way more on tattoos than dental hygiene. As Uncle Bill lights the firework fuse and scurries away, everybody is on pins and needles until suddenly and dramatically the fuse goes out. So, Uncle Bill relights the fuse and scurries away again, and the fuse goes out again, and so on, with Uncle Bill scurrying back and forth with his Bic lighter like a deranged Olympic torchbearer until finally the fuse burns all the way down, and the firework, emitting a smoke puff the size of a grapefruit, makes a noise like a squirrel passing gas. Wow! What a fitting climax for your traditional old-fashioned July 4th picnic. Next year, you'll go out for Chinese food. I'll end with a few more poems from the book Encyclopedia by Douglas Florian. The Dragonfly. I am a dragon, the demon of skies. Behold my bold, enormous eyes. I sweep, I swoop, I terrorize. For lunch I munch on flies and bees. Mosquitoes with my feet I seize. I am the dragon, down on your knees. The Praying Mantis. Upon a twig I sit and pray for something big to wind my way. A caterpillar, moth, or bee. I swallow them religiously. The Io Moth. The Io Moth has mammoth eyes. They are not real, they're a disguise to ward off birds and other creatures like garter snakes and science teachers. The Weevils. We are weevils, we are evil. We've aggrieved since time primeval. With our down-curved beaks we bore. Into crops and trees we gore. We are ruinous, we are rotten. We drill holes in bowls of cotton. We're not modern, we're medieval. We are weevils, we are evil. The Walking Stick. The walking stick is thin, not thick. He has a disappearing trick. By looking like a twig or stalk, it lives another day to walk. The Hornet. A hornet's born with yellow rings, ending in a point that stings. She builds a pulpy paper nest in which few choose to be a guest. A hornet is an insect killer. She feeds her babies caterpillars, spiders, flies, and if she's able, pudding from your picnic table. The Mosquitoes. Mosquitoes are thin. Mosquitoes are rude. They feast on your skin for takeout food. The Ticks. Not gigantic, not romantic, not artistic, not majestic, not magnetic, not aesthetic. Ticks are strictly parasitic. That's all we have time for today. Join me next month for That's a Laugh. I am Sharon Silcox with the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website at trianglereadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138.